Jim, I hear we have a traffic bulletin.
Yeah, per Mike Breitenstein, we've got an accident on southbound Highway 270 blocking the left lane, and it's midway between Page and Olive and causing some good backups.
Oh, that'll just be the beginning of the backup all the way down to Doherty Ferry in about 45 seconds.
That's right.
All right. More coming up in a few. Most of us remember watching the 1989 World Series between the Giants and the A's when a 6.9 magnitude earthquake hit during the pregame coverage of Game 3, and Al Michaels switched from being a baseball announcer to the play-by-play guy of earthquake coverage in the Bay Area. That was the last really big earthquake here in the United States. But according to a website called Earthquake Track, the U.S. has had 45 quakes in the last 24 hours. Most of those in Alaska and California and Idaho. We've had 332 in the last week. We've had over 20,000 earthquakes in the last year. And, of course, there was that big one in Mexico City. In fact, two big ones in Mexico City just a few weeks ago. All of this is prelude to my next guest, Catherine Miles, who's written a book called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Hi, Kate. How are you?
Hi. I'm good to be here.
Nice to have you. We went through some fear-mongering here in St. Louis and up and down the Mississippi Valley back in 1990 when a guy by the name of Ibon Browning told us that the earth was going to open up and swallow us when the New Madrid Fault finally had the big one.
I write about this in the book. I grew up in central Illinois and went to college in St. Louis, and I remember full well when that happened, and all of a sudden we started doing earthquake drills in my school.
Yeah. So naturally, we, and you, I'm sure, being from this area, are very skeptical about somebody saying, uh-oh, devastating earthquake coming, you better watch out. But that's not what your book is about. It's not just a warning. It's about how unprepared we are, right?
Right, and what we can do to be better prepared. And, you know, the threat of an earthquake on the New Madrid Fault system is certainly real. But the idea of being able to predict exactly when it's going to happen down to the day, which is what folks tried to do in the late 80s and early 90s, that's something we can't do. We can't predict the quakes. We don't know when they're going to happen. We do know that a catastrophic quake will happen on the New Madrid Fault Zone, and so that's why it's really beholden on all of us to be prepared for that eventuality.
But we can't tell if that's going to be tomorrow or 100 years from now.
Right, and so we should assume it is tomorrow, just in terms of making preparations.
Okay. Is there any kind of early warning system? I mean, anywhere in the country, is there any way to know, even 30 seconds ahead of time, quake?
Right, and we certainly have the technology available, and you mentioned the Mexico quake, and there's a really great example of an early warning system at play. After that devastating 1985 Mexico quake, the country instituted the first early warning system on the planet, and it's been used as a model for other countries, including places like Japan, the Philippines, and we have that technology here available. Congress has not yet funded it at the national level. California is doing some really innovative work and is currently testing a beta program, but it could very easily be the case that we all get a warning on our cell phones that say, hey, you know, quake coming in 60 seconds, take cover. And that really could mean the difference between life and death for people.
60 seconds is going to save lives?
You know, and I was skeptical about this too, but when I was out at UCal Berkeley and they were showing me how it works, if you think about what you can get done in 60 seconds, that's enough to run in, grab your kid out of bed, get under a dining room table. It's enough to stop traffic. It's enough to stop a plane from landing. It really can do a lot. It's not going to be as much as we get for like hurricanes or tornadoes, but it is going to be enough for people to take cover immediately.
Kate, you know as well as I do, if 95% of America got an earthquake alert on their phone, they would spend the next 60 seconds checking Facebook and Twitter and texting it to their friends. Nobody's going to act immediately on that.
Well, and that's true. And that's a real problem, right, is that we don't take natural disasters seriously. You know, if you look at Superstorm Sandy, for instance, 70% of the people who were ordered to evacuate didn't evacuate because they really didn't believe it would happen to them. And we really need sort of a cultural paradigm shift in that regard.
Okay, here's what I hope will happen. First of all, that we'll pay more attention to scientists and fund them in every department more than we do now. But also, I would hope that our infrastructure has gotten better since that Bay Area earthquake in 1989. Has it?
No, not really. I mean, yes, we have new standards for things like highways and interstates, and your listeners probably remember that sort of horrific pancaking of the interstates that we saw out in California.
Yeah.
But no, and when you look at a place like the Mississippi River Valley, you know, incredibly vulnerable to earthquakes. And what I found from talking to the Army Corps of Engineers for the book is one of the most vulnerable places is actually our levee system. And, you know, if that new Madrid quake happens, what we're going to see is not just the devastation from the earthquake and the resulting fires, but potentially catastrophic flooding as well.
Oh, don't remind me of 1993 when, you know, that was when the 100-year levees went kaput. And now we have the 500-year levees, but that 500 years has to be earthy for us to make it, right?
Right, right. You know, and you know what we're noticing again and again and again, and I think that the hurricane season has really shown this year, is this idea of a 100-year storm or a 500-year return. It doesn't really work anymore. You know, between issues of climate change, between induced seismicity, we really have to throw out those old models and create some new ones.
How are we at responding to quakes? We haven't had any gigantic ones, but we've had some along the way, some threes and fours. How are we handling those?
And, you know, this is where I think our country really shines, and we've seen this again and again in places like, for instance, Houston this year. As you know, disaster recovery, we're great at it. You know, we're really good at getting folks out. But what I would like to see us do is really invest on the front end of that and look more at building resilient communities, look more at sort of building an infrastructure that doesn't sort of require this huge expenditure of the Red Cross, the National Guard, our first responders getting into these sort of places that almost look like war-torn areas after a natural disaster has struck.
Yeah. I mentioned that most of the quakes that hit in the United States these days are either in Alaska or California, Hawaii. Those are really the three big ones. But I was surprised that in the top five is Oklahoma. Why?
That's right. And also much closer to you, Arkansas. So this idea of human-induced seismicity is something that scientists are really just beginning to talk about. And I dedicate several chapters of the book to this. Folks are probably familiar with this idea of fracking and wastewater injection associated with fracking causing earthquakes, which have made Oklahoma the most seismically active state in the lower 48. But there are all sorts of other ways that we're inducing earthquakes as well. Everything from mining and drilling, tunnel building, high-rise construction. And again, this is really changing the paradigm of what we know about seismic hazard and risk.
So when they're blasting apart the earth, that's affecting what the earth is going to do in return?
It sure is. You know, and what I saw in a little town in Connecticut is something as simple as quarry mining set off an earthquake cluster of about 300 earthquakes in 1 year.
You went down into a mine. Where was that?
This was in Idaho. It's one of the deepest mines in the country. We were down about 7,000 feet.
Yeah.
And looking at this idea of the way in which these very sort of, you know, basic practices that we've been doing for hundreds of years have been causing these things called rock bursts, which are actually sort of seismic activity. And you know, when you're mining, say, 100 feet below the earth, you know, that kind of rock burst could very well harm and potentially kill miners, but not do a lot of surface damage. But as we're getting deeper and deeper, and as our mining is getting more aggressive, these seismic events are getting larger and larger, and they run the risk of not just jeopardizing the miners, but the communities above them as well.
Yeah, I would think that that entire community of miners would be saying, look, if I got to be 100 feet below the earth, I want the earth to like my being there. I don't want it to be shaking and baking me while I'm down there.
They do, right? You know, and that's the same sort of thing. Is like these communities are saying enough is enough. But the question is, you know, are our elected officials listening? And a large time, I don't think they are.
Are there fault lines in this country that are near nuclear plants? You know, we had that famous story about Fukushima in Japan after the tsunami and the quake there. Do we have similar situations here in the United States?
Yes and no. You know, the earthquake that resulted in the Fukushima disaster was what's called a subduction quake, and that's where an oceanic plate is moving under a continental plate. Those are the most powerful earthquakes that we see in the world, that we see in Chile. That's what is the potential big one that's threatening the Pacific Northwest. So that level of an earthquake wouldn't necessarily happen within the continental U.S., but we definitely have very large faults running under some of these nuclear power plants. One that I outline in the book is the Indian Point power plant. It's just 20 miles north of New York City. And experts there say that fault zone is capable of, say, a 7.0 quake. And they think it could very well do damage to the building containing the reactors and could even, at its sort of worst-case scenario, result in the mandatory evacuation of New York City.
The mandatory evacuation of the most populous city in the country with 18 million people in its region.
Yeah, and think about that in terms of the economic effects on the country as a whole, or frankly, the planet as a whole. I mean, those are years and years and years in the making.
I don't know where the people are going to go. If you told them all to evacuate, you know, the good thing about being here in the Midwest is we could go out to places where there aren't many people. You know, you can go city, suburbs, exurbs, rural pretty quickly in Missouri and Illinois. I don't think in New York City you can get there. People spend 2 hours in traffic just trying to get there.
It's true, and relying on public transportation, too. But, you know, having grown up in the Midwest and knowing Midwestern hospitality, I mean, I think if that happens, you guys could invite them all out and make them a casserole, right?
Well, they'd have to get here first.
That's true.
Yeah. What other cities besides New York and St. Louis, to a certain extent, are really at risk in this country?
Sure. Well, Memphis. You know, Memphis obviously would be the heart of a New Madrid event, and, you know, that, again, would have really significant economic impacts to the U.S., particularly because FedEx and UPS both have hubs there. The Pacific Northwest, which I mentioned earlier, again, that's the one place where we really could see one of those catastrophic subduction quakes that would result in a tsunami. There's evidence that a quake as strong as the one that hit Fukushima is possible up there. Washington, D.C., as I joke in the book, unless you live in Miami, really you're at risk for a potential quake.
Yeah, in Miami, all you have to worry about is the water rising.
Yeah, no problem there. Just a hurricane now and again.
Yeah. So in those cities that you mentioned, you said earlier that, you know, the standards have been raised for some of these places, but they still have really tall buildings there. Are any of those buildings so-called earthquake-proof?
Well, and we should say that as earthquakes have happened, the one sort of positive thing that comes out of a major quake is we tend to learn a lot about how infrastructure responds, and we do tend to make improvements to things like building codes. So, you know, the newer the building has been built, the more likely it is that it's been built to a safe building code. And what structural engineers tell me is that really these sort of high-rise buildings, these sort of metal and glass structures, they tend to perform really well in an earthquake. So those are not their primary concern. What they're really worried about is what's called unreinforced masonry. So we're talking about brick and mortar, stone, that kind of construction. Those are the buildings that tend to fare very badly, particularly in a place like New York City. You know, those would be the ones where we really would see a lot of rubble created, same with L.A. Mm. And again, you know, we should say that one of the biggest killers in an earthquake is fire, right? So even if a building survives an earthquake, it may not be inhabitable again, and the resulting fire may do more damage than the quake itself.
I was trying to think this morning as I was looking through your book whether I'd ever felt an earthquake, and then I remembered probably about 10 or 11 years ago, on a Saturday morning, I heard and felt what really just sounded like really heavy trucks coming through my little suburban subdivision, and it lasted about 2 minutes, and I kind of rolled over, or it seemed like it lasted about 2 minutes, and I rolled over and I went back to sleep. And it wasn't until later that afternoon when I heard the news that we'd been hit by, I don't remember even what magnitude it was, we'd been hit by an earthquake. Have you ever been in one at all?
Little ones. I sort of joke about that in the book, too. A couple of little ones, you know, and I think that's true for most Americans. So few of us have actually experienced a significant earthquake, and so we suffer from a real lack of imagination when it comes to them. You know, most of your listeners probably, when they hear a tornado warning, you know, they know what to do, right?
Yeah.
They go down to the basement, they go to the bathroom, they know, and they've seen firsthand the devastation that a tornado can do. So they take it seriously. We haven't necessarily seen that, most of us, with an earthquake, and so we literally can't conceive of what it might mean. And so we tend to think that it can't happen to us.
You know, a lot of people in this area didn't pay attention to the tornado sirens until a few years ago when a swath of St. Louis was hit, including Lambert Airport, which had its roof ripped off. I think ever since then, people have paid more attention to that. Maybe you need the same sort of scare tactic with an earthquake. You have to have one first, and then after that, everybody's going to be like, okay, that siren's going off. I got to get under the table.
Right. And see, and that's the really dangerous game. And what I'm hoping this book will do is persuade people that they don't have to wait for that earthquake to kind of believe that it's true, that just knowing that it's a real potential is enough to start taking action to make sure that you have a plan and that you have the mechanisms in place to make sure that you can survive the quake.
So that's really the message to individuals here. It's not like we're ever going to be able to stop an earthquake. I can't fly backwards around the earth like Superman in the Christopher Reeve days and fix that. But I can at least make sure I know what to do if one does hit, right?
Exactly, exactly. And that's what I spend the latter part of the book talking about, what we can do both as individuals and as family members, and then also what we can do as communities and, frankly, as a nation to make sure that we are resilient, to make sure that we're ready, to make sure that we're prepared, to make sure that we're not spending years and years and years trying to rebound from a disaster.
The book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine Miles, my guest. Thanks so much for joining me here today, Kate.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.